Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Traditional treatment for obsessive compulsive disorder and other psychiatric conditions can take months, sometimes even years, to help patients. A newer so-called intensive therapy has been shown to achieve similar results in a matter of weeks. Dr. Avital Falk leads integrative therapy programs at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What's the big difference between what we think of as traditional therapy and this intensive approach?
So there actually aren't all that many differences in terms of the content of the sessions. It's really condensing it into a shorter period of time. So what we understand from research studies comparing doing weekly treatment, you know, once a week for 12 weeks or more versus doing that same 12 hours but in 1 week is that people actually get the same results and can get better more quickly. So while we're doing very similar things, we're just doing it on a more intensive and sped up basis.
The focus was on OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, but are there other psychiatric conditions that this can or would be or could be applied to?
Yeah, so one of the main strategies that we're using is CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy with a focus on what's called exposure and response prevention, which is facing the things that are difficult for you to do. So facing that obsessive thought or fear without doing the compulsive behavior. However, there are a lot of different types of anxiety disorders that respond well to that type of exposure treatment where you're facing the fear and the thing that's difficult for you. For example, if you have social anxiety disorder, the thing that might be difficult is judgment or evaluation from others. And so maybe it's difficult for you to engage in public speaking or to speak up in class or to do things like that. And for that as well, we would do exposure therapy and teaching the person at a level that they could handle and at a pace that they could handle how to face those fears. And so you can condense those types of treatments as well. So things that really focus on exposure therapy are quite amenable to this more intensive version.
And this more intensive version, does it work better with certain kinds of patients? Say, I know, again, the article that I read, it was youngsters, you know, early teens that were part of the trial.
Sure. So I personally work with children, adolescents, and young adults. Mm-hmm. However, there are studies that show that this works with adults as well. And actually in different countries, so for example, in Norway, they're using this intensive version across a spectrum for OCD, you know, with adults, with children, and finding that it can be really effective in giving people relief on a much faster basis.
When you talk about cognitive behavioral therapy, tell me what that involves.
Sure.
Facing your fear, but what does it look like?
Sure. So cognitive behavioral therapy really focuses on the cognitions and figuring out how to catch any distorted thoughts that you may be having. So, for example, thinking, you know, I'm never going to get better or everybody hates me. So some of those negative thoughts, we can identify that they might have some distortions within them. And we want to get people to be able to identify those thoughts and then shift them to a more realistic version. So we're not necessarily saying just see the positive, but we are saying think about what is the most realistic version of this thought. And perhaps that thought can either make you feel better in and of itself or possibly be more helpful in terms of allowing you to then do what you need to do. So the more realistic of those examples that I just gave might be, I'm not getting better as quickly as I would like, but with hard work, I may be able to do it. Or for the one, you know, something like I don't have any friends, it might be, I don't have as many friends as I would like, but I do have these two friendships that are very good for me. And then that might open you up and allow you to A, appreciate what you have and those two friendships and not feel as down and in despair, but also then be able to work on those other areas and friendships that are not going so well for you that you may actually want to productively work on. And having that really negative thought might prevent you from doing so. So we really work on the cognitions in that way. And then we work on the behaviors and having people shift their behaviors to ones that are more productive and effective and helpful for them in their lives. So that could be the type of exposure therapy that we're talking about and facing your fears, but it could also be doing things that are good for you even when your emotions are telling you not to. So if you're feeling really depressed, learning how to do things that feel nearly impossible, like getting up and going somewhere when that would be good for you, but your body's telling you not to. And so we work on the cognitions that people have as well as the behaviors that they engage in, all for the purpose of making someone feel better, because our understanding is that thoughts, feelings, and behaviors are all intimately connected.
What is the evidence that it's working?
What is the evidence that it's working? Mm-hmm. So are you asking with an individual patient or in general?
In general, how are you judging? So there's different kinds of therapies that actually change the brain matter mm-hmm. changes. Is that part of what you're looking at?
So currently in our center, we are not doing any brain scans of the patients in our intensive program, though mm-hmm. perhaps that's something we might do down the line. Mm-hmm. And like you said, there are studies that do look at that and actually do see visible changes in response to treatment. However, here what we do is we take very standardized measures of some of these symptoms. So for OCD, we specifically use the Yale-Brown Obsessive-Compulsive Scale or the Children's Yale-Brown Obsessive-Compulsive Scale. And that is a measure that's used across many research studies and can indicate the severity of someone's OCD symptoms and how they're interacting with those symptoms, how distressing they are to their lives. So we take that measure at multiple time points to measure someone's progress mm-hmm. and see how they're doing and make sure that they're responding to treatment. And if they're not, of course, we'd want to switch courses and figure out how to troubleshoot.
You know, this is I'm trying to think of what the parallel would be here. You know, take two aspirins instead of one. You're saying do it faster, do it for longer periods of time instead of dragging it out over several weeks, months or years or whatever it is. How did this approach change? When did people start thinking we could do this faster?
So, you know, over the past 10, 15 years, this approach has definitely been gaining popularity. And I think that, so, you know, research studies have been coming out pretty consistently over that time period. There was a meta-analysis actually published in October 2017, really reviewing all the literature on this. So it's a fairly recent development. However, I think that people were noticing that when they put more sessions in a week, they were actually getting more benefit. So more actually tend to be more in this case, and figuring out that they could actually finish this faster.
Does medication play a role?
So medication does play a role. So the gold standard treatment for OCD is a combination between medication and CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy. And so, you know, that is the same recommendation in terms of an intensive treatment program. The one caveat for that is that sometimes these medications do take a little bit of time to kick in. So if you're starting it all at the same time, you really want to do that combination therapy, you might have to think about starting the medication in time so that it kicks in combination with the treatment.
What is the rate of OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, in the United States? Is it on an upswing? Is it pretty stable?
So OCD is about 1-2%, but anxiety disorders more broadly, mm-hmm. You know, about 20-30% of people will experience an anxiety disorder at some point during their lifetime. So that's a much, much higher number. And so we do want to think about how to apply these cognitive behavioral therapy strategies to a wide spectrum of people.
A New York Times article about the program that featured you, and we'll have a link to that, by the way, on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Anyways, in the article, you asked your group of youngsters what makes OCD a disorder, and a girl said because it's messing up our lives.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, does their understanding of the disorder play a role in the success of their therapy?
Absolutely. So psychoeducation, which is education about the disorder and about treatment, is not only a precursor to treatment, but an important part of treatment. And so that is something that we review over and over to make sure that the kids and teens in the program, as well as their parents, truly understand what it is that they're doing and what it is that they're focusing on. And I think that it builds both buy-in into the treatment, but also motivation to actually work on it. The more they understand why and how things are going off the rails for them, the more that they can then take those treatment strategies and put them into effect.
Veterans, notably, have had a lot of success with this this more expedited treatment. Tell us about what we know about that.
So I'm not an expert in PTSD. That's not my area of specialty. However, my understanding is that, you know, the evidence-based treatment for PTSD, one of them is prolonged exposure, which is similar to what I was describing before, exposing someone or getting them to face the things that are challenging for them, and of course, when they're not dangerous. So for a veteran, the actual thing that they've experienced in their, you know, tour may have been actually true danger, of course, but the memories of those, our bodies are reacting, if we have PTSD, to those memories as if we're still in true danger. And so what we're trying to do is face the memories, face those fears, which are not necessarily actually dangerous, even though what the memories are of was dangerous. And so it is exposure therapy. And like I described, that exposure therapy can be done on a more intensive basis across a number of diagnoses.
Because the whatever the manifestation of the PTSD isn't, it isn't uniform.
Of course not.
Different people have different triggers, so to speak.
Of course. Yes, different people because they experience different traumatic events. And so, as I was mentioning, the traumatic event itself, regardless of what it may have been, was likely a true danger. And we, of course, don't want someone exposed to true danger again. Mm-hmm. But their bodies are reacting to memories or nightmares or things like that as if they're still in true danger. And that's what we want to help them be able to overcome.
The intensive, concentrated approach, you know, the first thing that came to my mind was, you know, a dollar sign. It's already hard enough to find good psychological health care. It's expensive. There's questions about coverage, that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. But what is the price tag? I mean, how much does something like this cost?
So it really depends where you're going. So there are programs across the country that do take insurance. For example, Rogers Behavioral Health has a number of locations across the country, and I believe that they take insurance for many, if not all, of their programs. And McLean in Boston has programs, intensive OCD programs, that do take insurance as well. And I think as these programs gain popularity and they're recognized as important and able to really prevent longer-term mental health problems if you can get the problem under control before, say, someone needs a hospitalization or something like that, my hope is that more and more insurance companies will recognize it, and it will be easier and easier for providers to set up programs that are recognized by insurance. But you are correct in that many of these programs currently don't take insurance, and they can be quite expensive because even if it's the same cost per session, doing that in a short period of time can be burdensome for families to pay that all up front. So, you know, at our program, we think about figuring out payment plans if needed to spread that out as if it was a normal course of therapy if needed, but that is a barrier that we are hoping to overcome.
Right. Well, Dr. Avita Falk, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Avita Falk is a psychologist for the Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City, where they have been working on expedited, intensive, concentrated approaches to therapy for psychiatric disorders such as obsessive-compulsive disorder and anxiety. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Guidelines and physician recommendations keep changing when it comes to screening for prostate cancer, the most common cancer in American men. The guidelines were updated recently in the Journal of American Medical Association. We'll post a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us by phone is Los Angeles-based urologist and author of the book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health, Dr. Dudley Danoff. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ann. Always a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so let's go back to the basics. Prostate's an important question. What's the test like?
Well, it's a blood test, PSA. It's not the airline. It's a prostate-specific antigen, a simple blood test. Urologists have always favored it, but the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force, which has no urologist on it, has been very dubious about it. In the past, they said, we don't recommend it. Now they've changed it. They said, well, it's probably a decision between a doctor and a patient, and urologists say everybody over 50 and under 70 should have a PSA. It does save lives. It makes the diagnosis of prostate cancer possible at an earlier and more treatable stage. But the recommendation now is more toward doing the PSA, certainly in an African-American, certainly in a family member who has a family member with prostate cancer.
Wait a minute. That task force are making decisions on physician recommendations on the issue of the most common cancer found in American men, and there's no urologist on the task force?
That's exactly right. Sounds like our government.
It sounds like a question for another day. I'm fascinated by that. Anyways, and what's the normal test result? Yay or nay? Or do people have it? Or
Absolutely. A 1 in 7 men will have a prostate cancer. 240,000 new cases will be diagnosed this year. Now, many prostate cancers are very quiet, sleepy cancers, mm-hmm. and they fall into our watchful waiting or active surveillance group and do not need active treatment or operation or surgery or a robot or radiation or hormone. But lots of those cancers will kill you.
Why so many? What do we know about the incidence of this and why it's so high?
Well, I don't think the incidence has changed. I think the PSA era has allowed the diagnosis of prostate cancer much earlier in a more treatable stage. And 40% fewer men die of prostate cancer post-PSA age than before. So that to the urologist is very significant.
The new guidelines do not endorse screening for men ages 70 and older. And we've talked about this before, but why?
Well, as men get older, the prostate cancers become less important. The urologists always say we want our patients to die with prostate cancer and not of it. So as a man reaches the eighth decade, it's likely that he will die of something other than a prostate cancer. Now, you know, today's 70 is different than a 70-year-old in 1960. I mean, mm-hmm. I have 100-year-old patients coming into my office every week, and many of them are surprisingly healthy, frail but healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So, that stop at age 70 is another thing that urologists are very, very skeptical about.
Now, there's been an increase in the number of cases of prostate cancer in the last few decades, or you're just saying it's the testing's gotten better and that's all a function of the PSA?
Right, and okay. We recognize it. So previous to PSA, I could only make the diagnosis with a digital rectal exam. I'd feel a hard, lumpy prostate, and 80% of those men already had metastatic disease. So the PSA has truly been revolutionary in allowing us to make the early diagnosis of prostate cancer, and the key to treatment is early diagnosis.
Let's turn to HPV. More than 1 in 50 people in England have been found to carry the cancer-causing human papillomavirus in their throat. That's according to the largest ever study on HPV published in the British medical journal Open. What is oral HPV? What do the symptoms look like? It affects men more than women, right?
It does. There are no symptoms. It's a virus. HPV is you can't see it with the naked eye. So the symptoms would be a sore throat, a lump in your neck. But it's certainly a silent killer. And the recommendation is that not only does it cause cervical cancer, which we've known forever and ever, not urologists, but more gynecologists, mm-hmm. but it also now oropharyngeal cancer. So it is a very, very potent virus. And the recommendation is that all boys ages 12 to 13 should be vaccinated against HPV. And you have to vaccinate a child before he's exposed or she is exposed to the virus, because once they're exposed, the vaccination is worthless.
Which is why you want it done young, at such a young age.
Very young. So it's been known for women, young women, to be vaccinated. The pediatricians do that routinely, but now the recommendation is in boys as well. starting at about age 12.
Why was it so much better known for women, the impact of HPV or the potential impact for them? And I guess why, what do we know about HPV that explains why it affects women, cervical cancer, but men, neck cancer?
Well, it has to do with oral sex.
Okay.
As simply stated, I mean, the fact seems obvious, and we've had some very, very high.
It's a geography issue. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And of course, smoking and drinking don't help.
Right. 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 And is oral and genital HPV, is one more deadly than the other, or not necessarily, or what?
Well, I don't hold myself out to be an expert on either one of those areas as far as cancer is concerned. Mm-hmm. I think bad news in both places.
And are there lots of different types of HPV?
Again, I think there are some subtypes, some subtypes for which the vaccine will not help. So there are some variants of the basic HPV virus. And I think they're working on vaccines to cover those variants.
Could you be exposed to the virus and not get the cancer?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, 80 million people carry HPV and are not don't have cancer. I mean, the incidence of cervical cancer is relatively low compared to everyone who has a cervix, and same is true of oral cancer.
Hmm. Has HPV been around for a long time?
Oh, well, I think so. I am not a viral historian, but I think so.
What else? Well, anyways, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday, and my guest is Dr. Dudley Danoff. He's a urologist in Los Angeles and author of the book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. If you have a question or comment about male sexual health, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What do people come to you most often for, Dr. Danoff?
Well, the most common thing I see in my practice is prostate cancer. I mean, I'm a general urologist. I favor oncology. So we do see stones, infections, erectile dysfunction, but primarily prostate cancer. That's the focus of my practice.
Are men becoming, well, you wrote the book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. You must have written it for a reason, because men needed more information, and that's why I have you on the show, because we don't, for some reason, culturally, we don't turn to men's health as much as we do women, ironically, because the studies are mostly focused on men.
Well, I mean, men are macho. They want to catch, you know, the pass in the last minute of the Super Bowl. I'm not sick. I'm stronger than anyone else, so a woman would never miss her annual pap smear or breast examination, but to get a man in for a prostate exam and a routine PSA, you know, takes an army, and I think that is at least part of the culture. I think also, just if I were to say the word penis, people would say, my God, that's a pejorative word. It's a body part. It's like an elbow to a urologist, you know, get over it. So there's something about male sexuality that's hidden. People are embarrassed to talk about it. Especially if it's erectile dysfunction. I have a friend. I mean, you've heard that ad. My friend.
Yeah, right. I've got a friend. You know, you say that, but if I open up the sports pages, there's ads for erectile dysfunction remedies all over the
place.
Yeah,
well, I think that's part of, you know, sort of getting the penis out of the closet and getting men to be more aware. Yeah, if your erection lasts more than 4 hours, you know, call everybody you know. So those ads have been very, very, very helpful for male sexual health.
There is an ongoing question about sperm counts in men and who wears, you know, whether you wear boxers or briefs or something like that. What do you hear from your patients? What do you know about that?
Well, I mean, many people would see boxers, briefs, it's a myth, but the reality is men who wear boxers have a higher sperm count, a better motility, which has little swimmers going upstream at a good pace. And the reason for that is the testicles, in order to have spermatogenesis, to make sperm, they like a lower ambient temperature than the body temperature. Hence, they reside in the scrotum. So when we wear tight shorts, what we're doing is we're pulling the testicles back up and raising the ambient temperature, and the sperm like it cool.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a myth. So both in numbers of sperm and quality of sperm, boxers are better than briefs. Interestingly, the amount of ejaculate, the amount of fluid doesn't vary whether you're wearing boxers or brief, but the sperm concentration and the increased mobility in boxers is better than briefs.
Does it matter what kind of pants you're wearing, let alone underwear?
Well, I mean, the same would hold true, tight jeans, you know, anything that brings the testicles closer to the body and the body's ambient temperature instead of the scrotum, which is a bit cooler, is not healthy for sperm.
What about bicyclists? That's been something that's been talked about before.
Well, again, that's more of what we call a perineal injury. That's the area between the back of the scrotum and the front of the rectum. And that used to have implications in terms of neurologic numbness. I don't think it affects sperm count very much, unless, of course, you're wearing, you know, tight bicycle shorts.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Danoff, that is all of the time we have today. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure, Ann.
Dr. Dudley Danoff, urologist in Los Angeles and author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. We'll have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control found 2.5 million American teenagers suffered from concussions in 2017. CDC researchers concluded that teens who played on a sports team were more likely to have a concussion than those who did not, and rates went up as the number of teams they played on increased. Joining us now by phone is concussion expert and associate director of research and development at the Sanford Sports Science Institute in South Dakota, Dr. Thane Muntz. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. How are you?
Good, thank you. Were you surprised by that number of 2.5 million teens?
It's certainly a higher number than what we've seen in earlier reports, and that does raise some eyebrows. And it's a situation where we've really had a hard time getting a grasp on what the actual numbers of concussions are among youth athletes and youth in general. And a lot of that has to do with the surveillance methods that have been used. In this particular report, they surveyed the athletes or the students themselves directly rather than looking at reports from emergency rooms or numbers that have been reported by athletic trainers. So it was a different way of looking at the injury and provides us with new numbers that really make us need to dig a little bit further.
It's a new method. The method is interesting. I mean, it's relying on relatively unreliable reporters, isn't that the case?
Yeah, you know, they used a...
Nothing against teens, but... You know.
Right. It's self-reported. So, you know, the advantage of using this method is that, again, you're going directly to a sample of individuals who may be at risk for this condition and asking them if they suffered, you know, any of these symptoms that are related to a concussion. So that's one of the shortcomings, however, is that you're asking teenagers to recall whether or not they, you know, suffered an injury or had symptoms that would be, you know, related to the injury over the past 12 months, which is a long time to remember and to know exactly, you know, when that occurred. And then, of course, you're expecting those teenagers to answer honestly and to not have any reservations about either, you know, underreporting or overreporting what may have occurred. So the number, again, is new, and it's given to us in a new method. But, you know, you raise the point, the reliability of the measure is a little bit in question. And, you know, it is much higher than earlier reports. I mean, mm-hmm. I would mention that, you know, the number that often gets cited and reported in literature and in the media is 1.6 to 3.8 million sport and recreation-related concussions across the entire United States.
So, not just in that demographic.
Right, exactly. Not just in those 4 years of high school individuals. So now you're saying that number is, you know, right in that same ballpark of just teenagers. So it raises the question, either, you know, are those other estimates really low, or is this sample much higher than what the actual number is?
The focus is on teens because such a high percentage of them are actually playing sports?
That's one of the reasons. Also, we do know that youth who suffer a concussion tend to have a longer recovery time. So the relative severity of the injury seems to be greater. And if you think about it in terms of susceptibility to further injury, if you have someone who's 14 years of age that suffers a concussion and they're playing sports throughout high school and maybe even beyond, there's a much longer time frame in which they could suffer a repetitive concussion. So if we also know are worse, if someone has, you know, that second, third, fourth concussion, that's generally going to be much worse than someone who suffers a single concussion.
Why is it that youth take longer to recover from a concussion than, I guess, an adult?
We don't know exactly. The biggest hypothesis is that the brain in these younger kids is still developing. So the wiring, if you want to look at it that way, the neural networks are still forming. So it may be during that state of maturation and development that when the injury occurs, it dysregulates the system a little bit more and causes a longer time to recover. We don't know exactly if that's the reason, but that's the best guess at this point.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about concussions in youth today. My guest is Dr. Thane Muntz. He's a concussion expert and associate director of research and development at the Sanford Sports Science Institute in South Dakota. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Muntz, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there as well. You've said, Dr. Muntz, that it's the concussions that occur in other sports besides football, sports like basketball, gymnastics, that concern you the most. I'm wondering why.
One of the things that, you know, happens outside of football and in a lot of sports is that when someone suffers a concussion, it's oftentimes from taking a blow to the ground, you know, getting knocked to the ground, hitting your head on the ground, taking an elbow to the ground. Those types of concussions can often, you know, anecdotally, we've seen it, you know, in the clinic, can often be more severe just because the force of the blow is greater. Now, that's not always the case, mm-hmm. but, you know, when a concussion does occur in those other sports, it's not necessarily part of the game. It's because the individual did get knocked to the ground or receive a blow that's unaccustomed. So, yeah, those athletes in those sports can suffer, you know, a more severe injury than in football. Again, that's a broad generalization and certainly not always the case.
Well, and also I wonder how much focus is put on that in those sports. We know that with football and hockey, everybody's, you know, on red alert all the time, but maybe not so much when you're at practice for gymnastics?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, when someone goes to gymnastics or plays in a, you know, tennis match, for example, you're not going in expecting to get a concussion. And if an event does occur that leads to a concussion, that may not be the first thing on those athletes' minds or even the athletic trainers' minds, because it is less common to occur in that particular sport. And I think that we've seen this. I can, you know, recall at the Olympics and, you know, skiing events where, you know, you see people go down and it's quite obvious that the individual has suffered a concussion, but they're often allowed to go back on their next run and continue. Whereas, you know, in football, if that were the case, mm-hmm. we would really, you know, be concerned about that player going down and being put right back in the game. Whereas in other sports, it's almost seen as a, you know, badge of honor or some, you know, measure of toughness of being able to get knocked down, injure your head, you know, your brain.
You say shake it off, yeah.
Right, and then be able to return. And some of those athletes are celebrated, you know, outside of football. So I do think we need to take a much broader look at this injury. And if I could, I just wanted to, you know, bring up a point from, you know, these very data that we're talking about in this new study. Mm-hmm. And if we accept these numbers of 2.5 million concussions among high school students on an annual basis, I think it's important to note that there's only a little bit over 1 million high school football players. And our best data from high school football and concussion suggests that about 5 to 10% of those players get concussed on an annual basis. So that's around 100,000 football players. So again, out of 2.5 million concussions, we're probably only looking at about 100,000 of those being from football. So where are the other 2.4 million concussions coming from? Now, those are coming from soccer, hockey, lacrosse, and other recreational type of activities, skateboarding, mm-hmm. you know, bike riding, mm-hmm. a lot of those types of things. So while there certainly is a greater risk of concussion in football compared to, you know, other sports and other activities, the instance of concussion and the injury itself is much broader. So I think our education, our awareness, our approach to being able to prevent and treat this injury has to go much beyond the sport of football.
You know, I have always had the misnotion or whatever the word would be, that young children playing football are not affected by this because they're not doing tackle. But you've found with children, it's an issue still.
It certainly is. I mean, we currently do research with middle school age football players. So these are 7th and 8th graders, usually between the ages of 12 and 14. And we work with a league that has tackle football all the way down to 2nd grade. And concussions do occur at all ages of football. And one of the things that's kind of related to this conversation is that the surveillance of concussions in youth football is somewhat problematic because there typically isn't an athletic trainer on those fields, maybe during games, almost never during practices. So a lot of these injuries get overlooked if they do happen.
Mm-hmm.
There are data suggesting that the concussion rates are a little bit lower in the younger ages of football players, but we really don't know just because the surveillance methods are inadequate.
How would you improve their surveillance methods?
Well, ideally, you
have those trainers out there.
Yeah, have athletic trainers, and there are studies showing that in high schools. There was a recent study that got a lot of attention showing that concussions in girls basketball and girls soccer were reported at a much higher rate in schools that had athletic trainers. And that doesn't mean that more injuries are happening. It just means that more injuries are being cared for,
right,
and being recognized.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so the ideal scenario for, you know, all of youth sports, including youth football, would be have athletic trainers on those sidelines so that when injuries occur, they can be recognized and cared for.
Are you seeing an uptick in girls in particular? Because, you know, for a long time, you know, and back in my olden days, you know, girls weren't in very many sports besides unless you were an Amazon, you know, and then you were in the volleyball and the, you know, basketball and then tennis and golf, you know, kind of a thing. There wasn't soccer and lacrosse and that kind of a thing for girls back in the day, or at least not commonly. Are you seeing more girls coming to the fore, speaking up about concussions?
Yeah, you know, one of the interesting things about concussion in sports that's fairly consistent across different sports is that if you have a sport like basketball, soccer, hockey, where both boys and girls play, the rate of concussion is almost always higher among girls in the same sport. And we don't know exactly why that is. It could be the
girls hit harder.
that could be the explanation. I will say, I think girls are tougher than boys. But part of that could also be that girls are more willing to tell someone that they're injured or to describe their symptoms, saying that they're not feeling well and that they think they may have been injured. So just that openness and honesty could be a greater part. There could actually just be a greater incidence of concussion. That's been speculated because girls have a relatively weaker neck strength compared to boys, and just some of the development in the sports of being accustomed to contact and being coached on how to initiate contact or how to receive contact is different among boys and girls. So again, we don't know exactly why those rates are different, but they consistently are higher for girls in, across a variety of sports.
Jane and Ostrander, you're on the air with Dr. Thane Muntz. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I was thinking that I've never seen a gymnast or a soccer player in a helmet, and I wonder if that might change with new statistics. Because when I watch gymnasts, I just cringe because of all the hard equipment they can hit.
Sure.
Dr. Muntz?
Helmets in football and hockey are really designed to prevent catastrophic head injuries and brain injuries, such as skull fractures and brain bleeds. They're not really designed to prevent concussion. That's why you still see these really high rates of concussion in those sports. So in a sport like gymnastics, where you do have some catastrophic injuries that occur with heads coming down and hitting the floor or hitting equipment, you know, a helmet potentially could reduce the risk of those catastrophic injuries. I don't know that it would do, or that the use of helmets would do a lot to reduce concussion in that particular sport either. For soccer, there are some soft helmets that are used, or headbands, padded headbands that athletes use. Those haven't really shown to reduce concussion rates, and there's some indication that, in fact, players are more aggressive when wearing the protective equipment because they have a sense of invincibility that they can go out there and create more contact without being injured. So there's always kind of that other end of the stick, that those unintended consequences that you have to think about as well. But in terms of catastrophic head injuries, yeah, I think helmets, you know, may be able to help with that.
Well, not just we've heard about that, that the helmets keep getting better and better designed for football. There's a school of thought that that makes the players hit harder and harder.
Right. You know, I think some people suggest, you know, going back to the leather helmets or without a face mask, and I think that's a little extreme. But the point being that, you know, 50, 60 years ago, when the helmets weren't as good, weren't as advanced and as protective as they are now, players knew better than to lead with their head or to initiate contact with their head, because they're going to end up with a broken nose, they're going to, you know, get knocked out, you know, something bad is going to happen. Whereas now, the helmets are so good that for many years, players were instructed and coached to lead with their head, to make contact by, you know, putting their face mask right between their opponent's numbers. That's the way a lot of people like myself grew up, being taught how to play football. And you were able to do that without any immediate injury. Well, now we're learning that not only is that placing you at risk for concussion, but also all those repetitive impacts that you're taking over the course of a season or over a career may be causing, you know, degenerative brain damage that you're going to see the results of 20, 30, 40 years down the road. So, I absolutely think that there has been a little bit of an issue with the helmets being so good that players don't recognize that they may be injuring themselves by using their head to create contact.
What about, I mean, are we seeing, so we have got the 2.5 million teens suffered at least one concussion last year in 2017, according to the CDC. Are we seeing parallel increases, or, I mean, correlation with CTE, the brain disease?
We don't have enough information on CTE right now. So for listeners who may not be familiar with CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, this is a degenerative brain disease which has been found in numerous former football players, boxers, other contact collision sport athletes. We don't know what the prevalence of that disease is in the general population. There just hasn't been enough broad study across diverse groups of populations to know, you know, what those numbers even are today, much less if there's been changes, increases or decreases over the year. So yeah, those correlations, you know, aren't really available right now. And I would mention, too, that one of the issues with the concussion surveillance data that we've been talking about and shortcomings is that, you know, we really need to get a handle on what actual rates of concussion are now so that we can study and understand whether we're making any dents at those numbers, if we're improving those concussion rates, you know, over years with intervention or with, you know, education, because until we get a firm baseline and really understand what the true rates are today, we're not going to be able to evaluate 10 years from now whether or not anything we've done has been effective.
Manessa in Chillicothe, you're on the air. Hi, Manessa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a quick, would love to hear your opinion. There's some research coming out of Northern Illinois University, Dr. Matthew Wilson, and he is looking at the prevalence of concussions and cognitive decline. And my understanding is that the results are showing it's not necessarily related to the concussions, but connected to playing the sport and taking the hit and the banging to the head.
Sure. Yeah. So.
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Munz.
Yeah, so I mean that's an important distinction. So a concussion is an acute injury that typically someone will recover from a concussion. But the, you know, other aspect of brain injury in sports like football and hockey and boxing, as you mentioned, are the repetitive head impacts that almost all players experience. And this could, in fact, be a much bigger problem than the individual acute injury of a concussion itself. In fact, you know, many researchers and scientists believe that CTE, that disease we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. is likely a result of the repetitive head impacts more so than a single concussion or a series of concussions.
Mm-hmm.
And this, again, is really alarming because it's hard enough to be able to diagnose a concussion, much less an injury by definition, which is subconcussive, which doesn't have outward signs and symptoms. And this is really where, you know, a lot of our research is focused and a lot of others as well.
Manessa, thank you very much for that call. And Dr. Thane Munz, thanks to you for joining us. It feels like it's an annual show I do on concussions at the beginning of every school year. So I appreciate your participation today.
Thank you, Anna. It's my pleasure being with you today.
Dr. Thane Munz, concussion expert and associate director of research and development at the Sanford Sports Science Institute in South Dakota. And once again, we'll post a link to that CDC report that found that 2.5 million teens suffered at least one concussion last year in 2017. Thanks for listening today. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.